Chapter 2. The Darling Young Lieutenant. On May 15, 1839, Ulysses S. Grant bade his family a stiffly formal farewell and left behind the small, provincial world he had inhabited. At 17, he was tiny for his age, weighing a mere 117 pounds and standing 5 feet 2 inches tall. At West Point, he would reach his full height of 5 feet 8 inches. It was typical of Hannah that she extracted from him a promise he would never resort to profane language at West Point. One senses that Grant was starved for outright maternal affection, for when he crossed the street to say goodbye to the Baileys, Mrs. Bailey and her daughters stood bathed in tears. Grant was taken aback by the emotional display, which struck him as a revelation. "Why, you must be sorry I am going," he said with dawning wonder. "They didn't cry at our house." Grant lugged a suitcase imprinted with brass tacks of his initials. To avert teasing, he had rearranged H-U-G into the far more palatable U-H-G, the shifting initials emblematic of his confused sense of identity. The boy nursed a certain wanderlust, the first hint of some broader vision of life, and was eager to set eyes on Philadelphia and New York. Nevertheless, he experienced such foreboding about West Point that he daydreamed about a travel accident that would abort the whole trip. "When these places were visited, I would have been glad to have had a steamboat or railroad collision, by which I might have received a temporary injury sufficient to make me ineligible for a time to enter the academy," he wrote with dry humor. "Nothing of the kind occurred, and I had to face the music." He traveled by steamer to Pittsburgh, then switched to a canal boat for Harrisburg. From there, he clambered aboard a train bound for Philadelphia and was thrilled as it accelerated to a maximum velocity of 18 miles per hour. During 5 days in Philadelphia, he boarded with his mother's relatives and roamed its streets with rapt attention, visiting the theater and touring Girard College. He looked like a hayseed from the heartland, a rather awkward country lad wearing plain clothes and large, coarse shoes as broad at the toes as at the widest part of the soles, in the amused memory of one female cousin. In New York, Grant experienced a fateful encounter with a foppish young man from Missouri named Fred Dent, who stayed at the same hotel. As Westerners, the two teenagers struck up an instant camaraderie, and when they discovered they were both headed for the military academy, traveled up the Hudson River together. Upon arrival at West Point, Grant registered under the name U.H. Grant, inscribing his name as Ulysses Hiram Grant in the adjutant's office. He then discovered, despite his unavailing protests, that he had been nominated for West Point under Ulysses S. Grant, and perhaps began to suspect that fate had pasted this label permanently on him. As soon as fellow cadets, including William Tecumseh Sherman, spotted the name U.S. Grant on the bulletin board, they made great sport of it and promptly branded the newcomer Uncle Sam Grant, or Sam Grant for short. Henceforth, he would be known as Sam Grant among the cadets. By the end of 4 years at West Point, he had capitulated to the tyranny of the clerical error and adopted Ulysses S. Grant as his new moniker for life. Grant was surprised that he breezed through the entrance exams, especially since 1 out of 4 candidates flunked. The tests included a physical to see whether candidates had dental or skeletal defects, as well as tests of penmanship and spelling. Once they passed, Grant and other new plebes had their heads shaved nearly bald and spent the next few months in summer encampment, sleeping in tents and drilling in an open area called the Plain before taking up barracks residence in September. Grant never forgot his initial glimpse that summer of General Winfield Scott, who came to review the cadets. A gigantic, stately man standing 6 feet 5 inches tall, he was all aglow in a profusion of medals and gold lace. I thought him the finest specimen of manhood my eyes had ever beheld. I could never resemble him in appearance, but I believe I did have a presentiment that some day I should occupy his place on review. For this shambling young man, short on ambition, it was an uncharacteristic mental leap into a shining military future. On September 14, 1839, Grant signed his enlistment papers, which required him to serve in the Army of the United States for 8 years. This was no idle act, and Grant would abide devoutly by this pledge. When the Civil War broke out, he repeatedly reminded people that he had vowed to serve his country in exchange for being educated in warfare, reinforcing a fervent indignation that Robert E. Lee and other Confederate generals who attended West Point had violated their sworn oaths. The new cadet, blue-eyed and clean-shaven, with a rubicund complexion, was quite handsome, bearing scant resemblance to the later general of the stubbly beard and weathered face. He was enchanted by West Point's natural beauty, writing home about its bucolic wonders and sighing over the beautiful river with its bosom studded with hundreds of snow-white sails. When he visited a house once occupied by Benedict Arnold, his fiery reaction foreshadowed things to come as he patriotically denounced Arnold as that base and heartless traitor to his country and his God. Notwithstanding his reluctance to go to the academy, he quickly accepted its sound practicality on the economic grounds touted by his father. The fact is, if a man graduates here, he is safe for life. When he surveyed his freshly uniformed self in the mirror, he laughed at the spick-and-span figure suddenly staring back at him. "My pants sit as tight to my skin as the bark to a tree," he told a friend. "And if I do not walk military, that is, if I bend over quickly or run, they are very apt to crack with a report as loud as a pistol. My coat must always be buttoned up tight to the chin." This snappy appearance did not last long, however, and Grant soon received demerits for careless deportment, untied shoelaces, and lateness for drills. He was so diminutive that when he donned a pair of overalls and went down to the riding hall, his spurs and huge, clanking cavalry sword seemed to dwarf his boyish frame. In Ohio, Grant had been the butt of taunts by town toughs, whereas the cadets discerned sterling qualities beneath his quiet, stolid manner. The academy counted 250 cadets in all, so that everyone mostly knew everyone else, and fellow cadets commended Grant's honesty, candor, and generosity. Perhaps the highest accolade came from a tall, rangy cadet, James Longstreet, who hailed from the Deep South and later won renown as the man Robert E. Lee dubbed "My Old Warhorse." With his doughty independence and integrity, he retained warm memories of Grant at West Point, citing his girlish modesty, a hesitancy in presenting his own claims, a taciturnity born of his modesty, but a thoroughness in the accomplishment of whatever task was assigned him. For 3 years, Grant roomed with Fred Dent, who also singled out Grant as "the clearest-headed young man I ever saw." He always wanted to do what was right, and we all had great respect for him. He was a singed cat, a great deal better than he looked. Grant also shared rooms with Rufus Ingalls, later distinguished as Quartermaster General of the U.S. Army. Although Grant experimented with tobacco, which was forbidden, he did not acquire a smoking habit and only occasionally partook of liquor. By stripping them of all luxuries and housing them in barracks of extreme simplicity, West Point introduced cadets to a rigorous military life. With two cadets squeezed into each cramped room, they had to fetch water from a downstairs pump, scrub floors, make their beds, and fold their sheets. At 5 a.m., they were roused from sleep by rumbling drums and marched off to the dining hall. Grant mostly obeyed institutional rules, with a few significant lapses. William B. Franklin recalled that cadets could not cook in their rooms, but often sneaked in meat and potatoes. One night, Grant was roasting a chicken in his room when an officer rapped. Grant stood rigidly at attention as the officer alluded to a telltale cooking odor. "I've noticed it," replied Grant, and the officer retired, thoroughly impressed by the innocent look on the cadet's face. As in Georgetown, Grant refused to be hazed when a strapping cadet named Jack Lindsay kept shoving him from the squad as they drilled on the parade ground. When Lindsay pushed him once too often, Grant retaliated by knocking down the larger boy, flattening him with a punch. In time, Grant, despite his short stature, developed a reputation for a fearless sense of fair play and was regularly approached by other cadets to mediate their disputes. The West Point curriculum was long on math, engineering, geography, and history, though it presented courses on artillery, fortifications, and cavalry maneuvers. Grant later laughed at the primitive tactics based on musket and flintlock weapons. In his first year, the coursework emphasized French for a straightforward reason. The French were the foremost military theorists of the day. The reigning figure in military strategy was Antoine-Henri Jomini, a Swiss-born officer who had fought by Napoleon's side. Jomini's ideas came filtered through the mind of the Academy's most charismatic teacher, Dennis Hart Mahan, who transformed the study of Napoleon into a worshipful cult. He adapted French theory to American frontier conditions, teaching lessons about flexible supply bases, the rapid movement of troops, and concentration of forces that Grant would faithfully apply throughout the Civil War. Mahan remembered Grant fondly. Grant's mental machine is of the powerful low-pressure class, which pushes steadily forward and drives all obstacles before it. It has often been said that Grant was ignorant of military history, but in later years he could recapitulate in minute detail the campaigns of Napoleon, Frederick the Great, and Julius Caesar, as the journalist John Russell Young discovered to his astonishment when he interviewed Grant in 1879. The stereotype of Grant as a flop at West Point is misleading. His performance was lackluster, not awful, and he proved modestly successful in selected areas. "I had no occasion for any aids in mathematics," he said. "The subject was so easy to me as to come almost by intuition." In a world of competitive young men, Grant could come across as a laggard. "In his studies, he was lazy and careless," said Rufus Ingalls. "Instead of studying a lesson, he would merely read it over once or twice. But he was so quick in his perceptions that he usually made very fair recitations, even with so little preparation." The Academy suffered such a heavy attrition rate that a year after Grant entered, his class was whittled down from 82 to 49 members. Although many of his letters speak fondly of the Academy, he displayed small interest in military matters and portrayed his West Point stay as a trial to be endured. The furthest he allowed his fantasies to range ahead was to imagine himself an assistant math professor at the Academy, followed by a college professorship. Only the specter of his father's disapproval kept him firmly stationed on the Hudson. "If I could have escaped West Point without bringing myself into disgrace at home, I would have done so," he reminisced. "I remember about the time I entered the Academy, there were debates in Congress over a proposal to abolish West Point. I read the Congress reports with eagerness, hoping to hear that the school had been abolished and that I could go home to my father without being in disgrace." Already possessing a literary bent, Grant often escaped into the world of fiction, devouring novels by Sir Walter Scott, Washington Irving, and James Fenimore Cooper, and serving as president of the Literary Society. Shy, close-mouthed, he did not dance, and came up short with the ladies, especially compared with the polished young Southern boys with their ingratiating manners. Perhaps most surprising was the talent he exhibited in a drawing course given by a popular instructor, Robert Walter Weir, who had studied painting in Italy and specialized in landscapes and historical subjects. with cartography in its infancy. West Point emphasized drawing so that future officers could sketch rough maps and record a battlefield's topography. The clarity and acuity of Grant's vision, his uncanny ability to visualize chaotic fighting amid the fog of war, would account in no small measure for his military triumphs. Grant executed fanciful Italian scenes and tender genre studies of Native Americans, and, in one droll, delightful painting, showed a horse with its head drooping into a feed bag, a picture notable for its palpable affection for the creature. Grant also thrived in horseback riding and was lucky that the Academy introduced equestrian classes during his tenure. Cadets training to be cavalry officers were expected to leap over hurdles, their sabers flailing in the air. Everybody noted the perfect harmony that united man and animal when Grant sat erect in the saddle. "In horsemanship, he was noted as the most proficient in the Academy," said Longstreet. "In fact, rider and horse held together like the fabled centaur." As in Georgetown, knots of cadets would gather and stare with hypnotic admiration as Grant subdued unruly horses, and one said appreciatively, "It was as good as any circus to see Grant ride." In scaling hurdles, he exceeded all rivals, and when cadets competed in jumps, attendants would hike up the bar a full foot higher to spotlight Grant's star turn. During the Civil War, Grant attributed some of his success to a thorough knowledge of Confederate officers stored up at West Point and in the Mexican War. Indeed, a goodly portion of the dramatis personae of the Civil War trooped through his academy life. He was mesmerized, if a bit appalled, by a zealous Christian cadet from a poor family in rural western Virginia, Thomas J. Jackson. At West Point, he came into the school at an older age than average and began with a low grade. But he had so much courage and energy, worked so hard, and governed his life by a discipline so stern that he steadily worked his way along and rose far above others who had more advantages. Grant remembered Jackson's bouts of hypochondria, his belief in possession by demonic spirits, his tireless bent for self-improvement. Grant never directly faced Stonewall Jackson during the Civil War, when he fought like a man possessed, his eyes said to be fiercely lit by inner fires. Among the older cadets, which included John Pope and Simon Bolivar Buckner, Grant was especially drawn to William Tecumseh Sherman, who was as witty and energetic as Grant was constrained in manner. "He was generous to everybody," Grant recalled, "and one of the most popular boys at the academy." Grant's critique of another older cadet, George H. Thomas, later hero of Chickamauga, prefigured his impatience with Thomas's lumbering style of command. At West Point, when he was commanding cadets in cavalry drill, he would never go beyond a slow trot. Just as soon as the line began to move and gain a little speed, Thomas would give the order, "Slow trot." The boys used to call him Slow Trot Thomas. Among younger cadets, the most impressive was the precocious George B. McClellan, who entered West Point at 15 after 2 years at the University of Pennsylvania. By a strange juxtaposition of fate, his class included George E. Pickett, of Gettysburg fame. After 2 years of study, West Point rewarded cadets with a 2-month furlough, and Grant celebrated this interlude as a long-awaited reprieve from his New York exile. "This I enjoyed beyond any other period of my life," he stated, with understandable hyperbole. By now, Jesse had followed his usual practice of trading up to ever richer towns, moving from Georgetown to Bethel, a mere 12 miles away, but a distinct step upward in socioeconomic status. He and Hannah had moved into an imposing brick house recently owned by Senator Thomas Morris, and noxious fumes no longer floated in from a nearby tannery. Jesse had formed a partnership agreement with E.A. Collins, under which Jesse would expand their Bethel tannery, while Collins hawked its products in the Mississippi River town of Galena, Illinois, forging a connection that was to prove consequential for Ulysses. Jesse planned to groom his two younger sons, Simpson and Orville, to take over his tanning business, a prospect pointedly spurned by Ulysses. As restless as ever, Jesse donated his time to a dizzying array of causes, sitting on the board of the Methodist Church and joining the local Masonic Lodge. Still a stalwart Whig, he had campaigned heartily in 1840 for William Henry Harrison, whose slogan in the presidential race was "Tippecanoe and Tyler Too." Harrison had been the hero of the Battle of Tippecanoe, and John Tyler was his running mate. Inspired by this slogan, Jesse took part in a campaign parade in which he pulled an oar in a gargantuan canoe mounted on wheels that was pulled down the town's main street. Many locals were offended by Jesse's ostentatious air of prosperity, his insufferable boasting about Ulysses, his outspoken politics. He was an uncompromising anti-slavery Whig, a strong temperance advocate, the richest man in town, owned a piano, wore gold-bowed spectacles, and sent his children to college, explained one townsman. Yet the hard-driving Jesse was enterprising enough to be elected mayor of Bethel within a decade. Encased in his starchy uniform, his frame well-toned by parade ground drills, the Ulysses S. Grant who returned to Bethel by stagecoach had the upright carriage of a cadet instead of his familiar boyhood slouch. Training had made him lean and muscular. When he encountered his mother, she didn't shower him with tears or hugs, but inspected him closely instead. "Ulysses, you have grown much straighter," she commented, and he shot back, "Yes, that was the first thing they taught me." The improvement proved only temporary. In the agrarian isolation of a small Ohio town before the railroad boom, Ulysses whirled in like some visitor from a faraway world who imparted strange lore of distant places. On Bethel's streets, he was often surrounded by flocks of locals who listened, mouth agape, to his stock of West Point tales, relieved to find him free of his father's vanity. In the emotional desert of the Grant household, Ulysses was ripe for romance and found his first love interest in a young woman named Kate Lowe, who lived in nearby Batavia. He rode over frequently to see her and experienced the early transports of desire. Before returning to West Point, Grant, in courting mode, even sent the damsel rhymed couplets to testify to his affection. "Kindly then remember me, I'll also often think of thee, nor forget the soldier story, gone to gain the field of glory." Back at West Point in the fall, Grant was briefly accorded the honor of being named a sergeant who exercised leadership in one of four companies formed for military exercises. Instead of being galvanized into superior performance, Grant preferred to languish. As he confessed, "The promotion was too much for me." As he accumulated demerits, in May 1842, he was confined to quarters for 2 weeks for speaking disrespectfully to a superior officer. He was stripped of his sergeant stripes and reverted to a private for his last year. Time hung heavy on his hands. The last 2 years wore away more rapidly than the first two, but they still seemed about 5 times as long as Ohio years to me. As so often in Grant's career, his mental depression acquired a physical correlative. During his last 6 months at West Point, he was gripped by a desperate cough that slimmed him down to 117 pounds, the same weight recorded during his entrance exam, even though he had gained 6 inches in height. 2 of Jesse Grant's brothers had died of consumption, perhaps adding an extra element of concern to Grant's condition. Despite his infirmity, Grant rode regularly and astounded people with his equestrian theatrics. routinely clearing a bar set at 5 feet by the riding master, the Prussian sergeant Henry Hirschberger. The most fearsome horse in the academy stables was York, an intractable animal dreaded by most cadets. When one classmate warned Grant, "That horse will kill you someday," he coolly responded, "Well, I can't die but once." The pinnacle of Grant's horsemanship came at graduation time, when the senior class performed mounted exercises before a vast throng of spectators. A young onlooker named James B. Fry never forgot Grant's bravura performance at the close. When the regular services were completed, the class, still mounted, was formed in line through the center of the hall. The riding master placed the leaping bar higher than a man's head and called out, "Cadet Grant!" A clean-faced, slender, blue-eyed young fellow weighing about 120 pounds dashed from the ranks on a powerfully built chestnut sorrel horse and galloped down the opposite side of the hall. As he turned at the farther end and came into the straight stretch across which the bar was placed, the horse increased his pace, and measuring his strides for the great leap before him, bounded into the air and cleared the bar, carrying his rider as if man and beast had been welded together. The spectators were breathless.
"Very well done, sir," growled old Hirschberger, the riding master,
and the class was dismissed and disappeared, but Cadet Grant remained a living image in my memory. Grant established an academy record that stood for decades, and the story's afterlife was no less remarkable. On his deathbed, when Fry called upon him, Grant could retrieve every detail of the memorable episode.
"Yes," he whispered, "I remember that very well. York was a wonderful horse. I could feel him gathering under me for the effort as he approached the bar. Have you heard anything lately of Hirschberger?"
When Grant graduated in June 1843, his rank was middling, not miserable, 21st in a class of 39. If one includes the many cadets who had already dropped out, Grant nearly stood in the top quarter of candidates who set out on the four-year marathon. The results were highly creditable in light of Grant's lackadaisical work ethic and the fact that some students entered with college preparatory work under their belts. Ironically, Grant scored best in subjects that might someday be of service in civilian life: math, engineering, and geology, and fared poorly in strictly military subjects, artillery and infantry tactics, confirming his disinclination for military service. Because of Grant's strong performance in math, Professor Albert E. Church soon encouraged him to return to the academy as an assistant professor, and Grant cherished this lowly aspiration. Although the feeling was far from universal, several cadets recognized Grant's uncommon strength of character. Shortly before graduation, classmate James A. Hardy prophesied, "Well, sir, if a great emergency arises in this country during our lifetime, Sam Grant will be the man to meet it." Looking back on his life, Grant declared that his happiest day was his last as president, with the possible exception of graduation day at West Point. For all that, he retained enduring respect for the academy and an affection for those who had survived its exacting ordeals. "He preferred West Point men as soldiers," wrote a later staff officer. "He loved them as friends. He thought higher even of Sherman and Sheridan because they were graduates of the academy." As he contemplated the military career to which he was now committed for several years, Grant coveted a cavalry assignment, an illustrious branch of service, and was crestfallen at being rejected. He had to settle for a commission as a brevet second lieutenant attached to the 4th Infantry Regiment, based at Jefferson Barracks, just south of St. Louis, Missouri. Grant spent a last summer in Ohio and ordered an infantry uniform from a local tailor. Evidently proud of his uniform and hoping it would impress the young ladies, he sported it on a trip to Cincinnati. "While I was riding along a street of that city, imagining that everyone was looking at me,
A little urchin, bareheaded, barefooted, with dirty and ragged pants held up by a single gallows, and a shirt that had not seen a washtub for weeks, turned to me and cried, "Soldier, will you work?" "No, siree, I'll sell my shirt first."
That Grant recalled this chance encounter with a nameless mocking waif underscores his uncommon sensitivity to ridicule. At the same time, he could not escape the barbs of small-town envy that had so bedeviled him before in Bethel. Because he wore a fancy uniform, some people scorned him as uppity. The stableman was rather dissipated, but possessed of some humor, Grant wrote. On my return, I found him parading the streets and attending in the stable, barefooted, but in a pair of sky-blue nankeen pantaloons, just the color of my uniform trousers, with a strip of white cotton sheeting sewed down the outside seams in imitation of mine. The joke was a huge one in the mind of many of the people and was much enjoyed by them, but I did not appreciate it so highly. According to one resident, Grant had fallen victim to shafts meant to land elsewhere. Such incivilities were really aired less at the genial, unoffending lieutenant than at his offending father, who was known to be very proud of him. In being assigned to Jefferson Barracks, Grant found himself posted to the largest military outpost in the United States, manned by 2 infantry regiments. As it had since the Lewis and Clark expedition, nearby St. Louis served as gateway to Western expansion, the army post throwing a protective shield around white settlers threatened by Indian raids on the Great Plains. Graced with gray limestone buildings, an enormous parade ground, and white picket fences on softly rolling hills, Jefferson Barracks was a prized posting and port of call for a succession of future generals. More than 200 Civil War generals passed through its expansive grounds. The commanding officer was Colonel Stephen Kearny, whom Grant valued as a model professional in the way he adhered to high standards without shackling soldiers with onerous rules. The young Grant, 21, who reported to Jefferson Barracks on September 30, 1843, misunderstood the nature of his special gifts. Ruddy and fresh-faced, he continued to train for a math professorship, plowing through mathematical studies as well as many valuable historical works, besides an occasional novel. He even contacted Professor Church, the West Point math instructor, to solicit a job as an assistant professor. Always attentive to his military status, he chafed at being shipped off to the infantry and made a futile request to be transferred to the dragoons, or mounted troops, who stood on a higher echelon. While Colonel Kearny expected his men to snap to attention at drills and roll calls, he showed a more relaxed attitude toward social activities beyond the base. Officers were constantly drafted for parties and cotillions in St. Louis, which made Jefferson Barracks a good place to shop for a wife. James Longstreet, also sent to Jefferson Barracks, extolled the hospitable city and remembered wistfully that the graceful step of its charming bells became a joy forever. Grant hoped to see his West Point roommate Fred Dent, who had grown up on a slave plantation known as White Haven that lay only 5 miles from the army base. When Fred was dispatched farther west into Indian country, he encouraged Grant to visit his family anyway. In the company of Longstreet, who was related to Fred's mother, Grant made a courtesy call there that autumn. Fred had smoothed the way with glowing letters to his eldest sister, Julia. "He said, 'I want you to know him,'" Julia remembered. "He is pure gold. I have never known him to use a profane or vulgar word. He is a splendid fellow." The Ulysses S. Grant who galloped up to White Haven was something of a pretty boy, his face not yet careworn from drink, depression, and business failure. His skin was smooth and unclouded, his features attractively regular, and he cut a fine figure in a blue uniform with gold buttons running down the front. Although Julia Dent was then at boarding school in St. Louis, her younger sisters swooned over the second lieutenant.
Emma Dent, age 6, thought him the handsomest person I had ever seen in my life, and left a detailed account of her first impressions. He was very youthful-looking, even for his age, which was just 21. His cheeks were round and plump and rosy. His hair was fine and brown, very thick and wavy. His eyes were a clear blue and always full of light. His figure was so slender, well-formed, and graceful that it was like that of a young prince to my eye. Nellie Dent, 15, equally smitten, began to indulge in romantic hopes. Warmly received by the Dent parents, and with these adoring sisters panting after him, Grant began to canter out to Whitehaven with some regularity. Enchanted by the family, Grant sometimes lingered there too long, returning late for meals at Jefferson Barracks. He possessed an easygoing side that never quite conformed to the strict dictates of Army discipline. Captain Robert C. Buchanan, overseer of the 4th Infantry Mess, was a martinet of the old school who took sadistic delight in harassing recent West Point graduates, fining them bottles of wine for tardiness. 3 times in 10 days he levied this penalty upon Grant, who bristled at the unwanted reprimand.
"Grant, you are late as usual. Another bottle of wine, sir."
"Mr. President," Grant replied, "I have been fined 3 bottles of wine within the last 10 days, and if I am fined again, I shall be obliged to repudiate."
"Mr. Grant, young people should be seen, not heard."
This exchange is noteworthy, for a decade later, Buchanan would reemerge as a major nemesis in Grant's career, with highly destructive consequences. At this point, Grant had no notion that St. Louis might form the backdrop of pivotal moments in his life. The city already ranked as a major port, its crowded wharves swarming with river captains, traders, fur trappers, miners, and merchants who supplied pioneer families. French and English were still spoken on its streets, reflecting its colonial roots. As a border state that permitted slavery, Missouri threw into dramatic relief the tensions roiling the country prior to the Civil War. From his growing liaison with the Dents, Ulysses S. Grant would be forced to straddle 2 incompatible worlds, the enterprising free labor economy of the North and the regressive world of Southern slavery. An influx of liberal German immigrants had introduced into St. Louis a sizable community of small farmers with an abolitionist bent, sharpening tensions with large planters over slavery. Poised on a hill amid a grove of lofty trees, the main house at Whitehaven was tan-colored, with dark brown edges, giant stone chimneys at both ends, and a 2-story veranda in front. It boasted a barn, a lime kiln, an ice house, a chicken house, and other amenities. The Dents had moved out from St. Louis, making this their primary residence to escape pollution and disease prevalent downtown. With prices still affordable, they had amassed 850 acres of deeply rolling woodland. The Dent daughters always viewed Whitehaven through the softening haze of nostalgia. "Our home was then really the showplace of the county, having very fine orchards of peaches, apples, apricots, nectarines, plums, cherries, grapes, and all of the then rare small fruits," wrote Julia. And Emma, "The farm of Whitehaven was even prettier than its name, for the pebbly, shining Gravis Creek ran right through it, and there were beautiful groves growing all over it." The breathless prose thinly disguised the brutal reality that the Dents owned 13 slaves. The figure would rise to 30 within a decade, who grew the cash crops of wheat, oats, corn, and potatoes that formed the basis of the family wealth. Not until February did Grant meet Julia Dent, 4 years his junior, who had just wound up 7 years at a Tony finishing school in St. Louis. Elegance, taste, and refinement always qualified as magical words in Julia's lexicon. Never a highly motivated student, she was nonetheless a voracious reader and well-educated by the standards of her day. She loved the Iliad and the Odyssey, and anything that savored of mythology and history. Her literary tastes ran the gamut from Samuel Johnson to Lord Byron to Victor Hugo. Perhaps with the benefit of hindsight, she claimed she had told her classmates of her wish to find a soldier, a gallant, brave, dashing soldier. She had spent the St. Louis winter with her parents' friends, the O'Fallons, who had introduced her into local society, where she was courted by a steady procession of eligible young officers from Jefferson Barracks. Both as a young girl and as a mature woman, Julia had a penchant for viewing the world through rose-colored spectacles. Late in life, when writing her memoirs, she depicted her girlhood in the flowery prose of a romance novel, allowing no shadows to tinge her past. The daughter of noble, brave, true, and loving parents, she had been born after four boys and was thus a veritable queen in our household, a spoiled pet. The first, ripest, mellowest of apples, peaches, and pears were mine, as also the brightest of flowers, all of which I owed to my brothers. She presented her childhood as the picturesque saga of a southern belle pampered by adoring slaves. The dear old black uncles always brought to me pet rabbits, squirrels, and all the prettiest birds' eggs they found. Besides, we always had a dusky train of from 8 to 10 little colored girls of all hues, and these little colored girls were allowed to accompany us if they were very neat. In Julia's view, the Dent slaves were all very happy. At least they were in Mama's time, though the young ones became somewhat demoralized about the beginning of the rebellion, when all the comforts of slavery passed away forever. It is not surprising that Julia Dent grew up seeing her girlhood in these storybook terms. It is surprising that when she wrote her memoirs as an elderly woman, the Civil War and Reconstruction had done so little to temper these retrograde views. When Julia returned to Whitehaven that February, she had heard flattering descriptions of Grant from her mother and knew her sister Nellie already angled for his affection. Grant was about to ride off after a visit when he turned and saw Julia. The beardless lieutenant, young and inexperienced, made an immediate impression on Julia Dent. According to Emma, Grant told her, "It was a case of love at first sight, that he had never had but the one love affair, but the one sweetheart in his life. Not even the boyish amours that usually precede a young man's real passion had ever been his." But it took time for Grant to fathom the depth of his attachment to Julia, and she was also slow to acknowledge the growing amorous nature of their mutual attraction. Grant repaired to Whitehaven up to 4 times weekly, to the point that he and Julia grew inseparable. He loved her spunk, gumption, and resolutely upbeat personality. Whether strolling by Gravis Creek or taking long rides down country lanes, they were totally comfortable with each other and fell into easy conversation. Grant delighted in teasing her affectionately, often playing practical jokes and showing a whimsical wit. When Julia's pet canary died, Grant crafted a tiny coffin for the bird, painted it yellow, then coaxed 8 young officers into attending a mock funeral. Even though Grant did not dance, he and Julia became fixtures at military balls. When Grant failed to show up at one, another officer inquired of Julia, "Where is that small man with the large epaulettes?" By Julia's own admission, she never counted as a stunning beauty. It is needless to mention what everyone knows, that Dame Nature was most chary of her gifts to me. No single special talent did she bestow, and of personal charms she was simply miserly. As a young girl, she worshipped an elusive beauty that she could never quite possess. "I used to cry when I was a little girl because I was so ugly," she confided to a friend. "Never mind, Julia," my dear mother would say. "You can be my good little girl." I used to wish I could ever once be called her pretty little girl. On some level, Julia seemed as famished for love as Grant. Julia's most glaring defect was a congenital lazy eye, a so-called strabismus, which meant that one eye turned inward. One story claims that she suffered a childhood eye injury when an oar struck her in a boating accident. This problem shadowed her life, and surgeons repeatedly urged her to repair it. "I had never had the courage to consent," she said. Her vision would worsen with the years, making it difficult to concentrate for sustained periods when reading or writing. Ulysses or a companion often read aloud to her. Julia was so self-conscious about the wayward eye that, even in the White House, she preferred to pose for photographs in profile. Although Julia stood just 5 feet 2 inches tall and grew stout and homely with the years, she was a dainty adolescent with many attractive features. I can only remember my abundance of soft brown hair, a fair complexion, and everyone told me my feet and hands were fairy-like. There was something captivating about her personality, with a zest, a warmth, and an animation that must have been balm to Grant's soul after his parched Methodist upbringing with its legacy of stifled feelings. However plain others found her, for Grant, she stood forth as the perfection of womanhood. From his reaction to Julia, one can see how much he secretly yearned for open displays of affection and needed the emotional outlet she so abundantly provided. For Julia, Grant descended like some heavenly apparition in uniform. "I thought he was a knight from one of the romances that I used to read. He entirely enchanted me. He was handsome, kind, honest, brave. He was scarcely real to a little girl like myself." She loved his graceful form in the saddle, his sly humor and facetious quips, his shyly boyish manner. Julia sensed a decency about Grant that set him apart from other young soldiers. She was the first to discover that the supposedly silent lieutenant was a riveting raconteur, always ready with a rich treasury of anecdotes. But to her dismay, when others stopped by, Grant tended to clam up. "I finally said, 'Ulysses, I told these people you were a fascinating and wonderful conversationalist. I think they have gone away disappointed. Why can't you be as interesting to them as you are to me?'" Julia was destined to be the bedrock of Grant's life, and he was a hero in her eyes long before he became a national hero. They formed the deep bond craved by bashful men who need the unconditional devotion of one loving, loyal woman. In the face of whatever doubts beset Grant, Julia offered implicit faith in his ability to succeed, a faith that endured even amid catastrophic failure. She was the first to divine the special qualities that lay behind his modest exterior. From early on, she believed in him more than he believed in himself, and was more ambitious for him as well. She bolstered his confidence, soothed his wounds, and pierced through his shyness until he learned to count on her constant strength. Whatever her feminine charms, she had a core of steel, a will so fixed that family members nicknamed her the boss. In future years, Grant would seem adrift when Julia was not around. As the cosseted eldest daughter, Julia grew up with an idealized picture of her father, Colonel Frederick F. Dent, who pumped her full of expectations that squared with his preferred self-image as a patrician planter. The colonel title was purely honorific. "He was one of the most prominent citizens of the state," Julia said, insisting he had been the kindest of masters to his slaves, who all adored him. She went so far as to say that he was most kind and indulgent to his people, i.e. slaves, too much so, perhaps. Clad in a long black coat, Colonel Dent often sat on the front porch, puffing his pipe and flipping through newspapers. A photo of him presents a fiery, pugnacious man who directly confronts the camera. He has a bulbous nose, bushy eyebrows, wispy gray hair, and a sour, unfriendly expression. His hooded eyes stare back warily at the viewer. He was ferociously reactionary, loved to curse, and was unapologetic about the slaveholding South. Dr. William Taussig, a local mayor, remembered him as a hot-tempered character who feuded with neighbors and brooked no opposition.
"He was a gentleman of considerable energy, masterful in his ways, of persistent combativeness, of the grim, set purpose peculiar to the Southerners of the old generation, and was, where foiled, inclined to be vindictive."
"Old man Dent was a man without tact or respect for anybody," a Grant friend recalled. "He was a fat old man who drank a good deal."
Colonel Dent could be cordial until the talk turned to politics, and then he grew dogmatic. Endowed with the entrenched prejudices of the planter class, he was fond of saying commerce had been ruined by Yankees who came west and reduced business to a system. Although he identified with Southern gentry, Frederick Dent was a Maryland native who made his earliest money performing road surveys and trading fur on the eastern seaboard. He married the beautiful young Ellen Bray Renshaw, who was born in England, grew up in Pittsburgh, and was educated in Philadelphia. Around 1816, they struck out for the frontier and moved to St. Louis. Julia cherished the family legend of how they had lashed logs together to form a flotilla of three rafts, with little wooden cabins set on each raft, then floated from Pittsburgh down to Illinois before completing the final stretch by carriage. Ellen Dent had all the sweetness and none of the vinegar in her husband's dyspeptic nature. Pretty, demure, with a kindly nature and delicate health, she remained homesick for the refined life she had left back east. She was a small, slender woman with rather serious gray eyes, a smiling mouth, and a gentle voice, wrote daughter Emma. "I remember that she wore snowy caps and dainty kerchiefs on her head, as I have occasionally seen very old-fashioned old ladies do since." Ellen Dent read aloud to her children, encouraged them to play music, and fostered the stimulating cultural atmosphere of the household. It is a striking feature of Grant's early life that women spied his hidden potential and forecast great things for him, whereas men counted his gentleness against him and overlooked his virtues. Ellen Dent immediately took a fancy to Grant, charmed by his unspoiled nature and quiet demeanor and his common sense in political discussions with the colonel, a Jacksonian Democrat. Often after Grant returned to Jefferson Barracks, she declared, "That young man will be heard from someday. He will make his mark." As with Julia, Ellen's premonitions only grew more pronounced with time. "She prophesied that he would rise to the highest seat in the government," Julia wrote. Unfortunately, Colonel Dent governed his daughter's fate with an iron fist and made no bones that he opposed her marriage to the young officer. With Grant, he feared Julia would relinquish the style of life to which he had accustomed her. "Old man Dent was opposed to him when he found he was courting his daughter and did everything he could to prevent the match," recalled Mary Robinson, one of the Dent slaves. The problem was not one of personality. Colonel Dent found Grant pleasant enough, but hard-headed money concerns. He took a dim view of army life and the economic austerity that accompanied it. "My father knew how arduous, pinched, and restless was army life, and how it provided few of the home comforts and opportunities for the care which a woman in delicate health might require," explained Emma. On the other hand, Julia was a young woman of rare determination, and Grant, a young man soon renowned for his tenacity. Grant hardly needed another despotic father figure in his life, but that is exactly what he got. It did not help matters that the abolitionist Grants came to detest the slave-owning Dents and vice versa, leaving Julia and Ulysses caught in a crossfire that lasted for decades. It could only have damaged Grant to be at the mercy of both an adoring but overbearing father and a hypercritical future father-in-law who thwarted his desire to marry for several years. Trapped between these two men, the young officer was condemned to experience a prolonged adolescence
in which he could never fully assert himself without getting slapped down. That spring, Grant learned his infantry was being shipped to Louisiana. For Ulysses and Julia, the looming separation revealed the degree to which their emotions had been knotted together. Seizing the initiative, he decided to propose to her and ventured out to Whitehaven on a stormy night that tested his youthful mettle. When he reached Gravis Creek, which ordinarily lacked enough water to run a coffee mill, Grant joked, he encountered a churning, foaming river swollen by torrential rain. Throughout his life, he had a superstitious dread of turning back, a perfect metaphor for his bullheaded determination, and dove into the overflowing creek on horseback, turning up soaked at Whitehaven. We all enjoyed heartily the sight of his ridiculous figure with his clothes flopping like wet rags around his limbs, said Emma. Julia's brother John, who was taller than Grant, gave him dry clothes that only made him look more laughable. Aware of his comical appearance, Grant blushed furiously. During a week-long stay at Whitehaven, Grant waited for a private moment with Julia, and found it when, driving her by buggy to a St. Louis wedding, they paused on a bridge over a ravine. On this ride, he declared his love and told me that without me, life would be insupportable, Julia recorded. I was surprised at his telling me this, for although I was just 18, I was very young for my age and very shy indeed. When he spoke of marriage, I simply told him I thought it would be charming to be engaged, but to be married, no, I would rather be engaged. Her reluctance upset Grant, but he realized he must tread carefully and exercise patience with this sheltered girl, especially when she pleaded with him not to tell her father about their engagement. Before leaving for Louisiana, he invited Julia to wear his class ring. Oh, no, she objected. Mama would not approve of my accepting a gift from a gentleman. In the end, she wore the ring. Unaware of this secret engagement, Ellen Dent hoped the relationship would prosper. Colonel Dent hoped that with Grant packed off at a considerable distance, Julia's emotions would cool off. She would come to her senses, and she would enter into a suitable match with a more affluent man.